You all know how much conventional orthodox Buddhist teaching stresses the teaching of anatta, translated as no self, no soul, no permanent entity, and so on. If one wants to understand anatta, is it not necessary to know precisely what we mean by atta? The prefix an means not. Not atta. What is atta? And yet, so much is said about anatta with hardly any knowledge whatever of what the word atta stands for. It is equated, the Pali atta is equated with the Sanskrit atma. But the usual definition which they take out of the Upanishadic or Hindu Sanskrit atma is the limited, mistaken definition, or if you like, the symbolic presentation of atma as an entity. In the oldest and the greatest of the Upanishads, the Atma is unquestionably presented as that which is unborn, ageless, undying, thirstless, hungerless, sorrowless. What can the mortal understand from those words? They're all negative terms. They are the negation of our ordinary experience. But it was only in these terms that that which was realized transcendence could be expressed. Transcendence is the positively inexpressible. That is to say, inexpressible in positive terms, in word or in thought. It is the inconceivable. It cannot be known in the ordinary logical, intellectual sense. It is experienced, it is realized, and the individual through whom such experience has taken place affirms that the transcendent is. God is. And this realized transcendence received the two words Atma and Brahman. Atma because the question which was originally asked was, who am I? It is the subjective approach. Brahman is the word which is used as the end point of the objective approach. What is ultimate reality? And the answer is Brahman. Who am I? The answer is Atma. And since the arriving at this realization by the removal of veil after veil of conceptions, pictures in the mind, of thoughts, of feelings about it, and all the rest of it, having made the mind completely empty, what was left was this transcendence. In intense realization, not a will-o'-the-wisp. This is the point. One quickly discovers a will-o'-the-wisp, and succeeding generations just discard it. But neither Atma nor Brahman nor God nor the Absolute have been discarded. Through the ages, this realization has taken place. So having made the positive affirmation that transcendence is, asking the question, what is transcendence? Well, you can't answer in words. You can't present a thought, and therefore a system of thought, an idea. How can you present an idea, a conception of that which is non-finite? The conceivable, the thinkable, the picturable, that with which you can have dealing, is the finite. But this, the infinite, which functions through you when you are in that state, how can you talk about it? Or think about it afterwards? And yet, returning to the ordinary state, you just know that that transcendence is, and you just affirm it. You experience afterwards the consequences of that realization. Those consequences are not only experienced by you yourself, but they affect mankind around. But when asked for words, then you use all the negatives. It is not this, it is not this, it is not that, objectively, if you're talking of Brahman. It is not birth, it is not growth, it is not age, it is not decay, it is not death, if you're talking about yourself. The Pali form Atta, for the Sanskrit form Atman, signifies precisely this. Now it is perfectly true that people with insufficient power to express these things in words allowed this birthless, ageless, deathless, sorrowless, thirstless Atma, stainless Atma, to descend into a mannequin soul idea. And so people talked about my Atma, your Atma, which is a lie. There's no such thing as my soul, your spirit. The universal is the universal. Can we talk of my space and your space? Can you talk of my energy and your energy? Even in ordinary matter-of-fact physical terms, we can't. It is energy as manifested through this container and expressor of it. So you see how this mental confusion has bedeviled this teaching of anatta. That which is the infinite, which is transcendent, is of an order of being and existence quite unlike what we experience here, the natural order. Physis, physics, things, non-living or living, whichever they are. They are the two great groups. In between, there is this extraordinary realm for which I can only use the word mind only. Mind only. Mind in its own state, which is also different from things and also different from transcendence. But the three orders, now when we talk, we will naturally talk in this manner, which is misleading. Do bear that in mind. But you can escape the misleading part of it if you are really awake to it. The three orders, transcendence, mind only, and all this natural order of energy in finite manifestation, are all one total reality. This is the great thing to realize. And because the living of the holy life, religion in its essence, in its actual expression, in its full flowering in our life here, means the realizing, the making real of this one total reality. And what we can talk about, only talk about as three orders of being and existence, come into perfect unity in such realization. And the word Atma represents that state of realization. When my consciousness functions in the ordinary way, apart from that state of realization, then I mistakenly attribute transcendence or birthlessness and deathlessness to that which comes into being, changes, and passes away. But comes into being, changes, and passes away as an appearance of unborn, undying energy. So the whole process, the universal process, is an appearance of this which is other than appearance, which has no appearance, which has no laws, which has no dimensions, which has nothing that I can talk about or anyone can talk about. It's easy to constrict this into a philosophy, a system of thought. Now this is what we must beware of. If we like to indulge the intellect and be philosophers, all right, indulge the intellect, but you'll pay the penalty for indulging the intellect. Because the philosopher's intellectual indulgence presents a beautiful picture, an appearance of reality, but unfortunately it gets mistaken for reality, and conduct and our human relationships is deduced logically from that appearance which is mistaken for reality, with consequent sorrow and trouble for us. Now we consider this in another way at our last meeting. You remember we spoke about the importance of having some sense of transcendence, if life were to be made a whole, harmonious, if our human relationships were to be real human relationships and not a travesty. If you remember, we saw that right relationship is essentially there all the time. It is I who spoil the right relationship because of my ignorance, my egoism, vanity, ambition, jealousy, resentment, greed, power lust, my separate selfness, which embodies all these things. You remember? We touched upon it that way. Now today, we have tried to approach it in a different way, with this statement of the Buddha, or this teaching attributed to the Buddha, that all this, the body, the mental processes, are anatta, meaning that they are the ephemeral, mortal, the dying, and therefore painful, sorrowful appearance of that which is indescribable, the unknowable by intellect, which cannot be put together in shape or form as such. Now you see, if we can really penetrate into this teaching of anatta, we will be able to be free of grasping at that which is only temporal. The immortal cannot be grasped. It is there. There is nothing to grasp. Can you pack up a bit of space in your kit bag? Try. Can't do it. Can you appropriate a piece of immortality for yourself? A piece of the one total reality for yourself and separate it out? But this is what we try to do, and our path is strewn, littered with wrecks, with suffering, with misery. In consequence, treat this not as a philosophy, not as guiding ideas, but let the ideas sort of stir something from within so that there is light. Light is something which you can't take and make into an image. You can't pack it up anyway. It's light. That's all. See, when there is realization like that, there is an extraordinary state of inward stability, peace, joy, a calm joy, right in the midst of difficulty, of storm and stress. That joy is there. And let me use the commoner garden phrase, it wins in the long run. It can be suppressed. One can be so buffeted, so terribly hurt by the immediate situation and circumstance that that light gets dimmed. It seems almost as if it has been swallowed up by the darkness. But it will come up again. Good old story of the phoenix. It'll come up again. The mistake we make is, I want it to come up. The moment I want it to come up, it is for myself. Restriction, of the unrestrictable. It cannot be done. Let it come. It doesn't matter. But I shall be dead before I have realization. I never have realization. The one total reality realizes through this. If this is prepared to live, die instantaneously. Not otherwise. And this is what means real happiness, not momentary pleasure or satisfaction. Therefore, if we can really understand, that is, be awake to the fact that this which is the temporal, the passing, changing appearance, which will necessarily die, if we can understand that this is of that nature, anatta, not the unborn, unaging, undying, unsorrowing, unstained. If you can realize that and not grasp at this and all that derives from this, which is the totality of our worldly life in the worldly sense and in the worldly manner, then the religious consciousness has completely flowered out, and there is fulfillment. Now, this is the real meaning of renunciation, of sacrifice, to relinquish all, everything. To relinquish the grasping after holiness, after perfection, after realization, after God. You'll have far, far greater satisfaction and pleasure grasping a few kittens and looking after them than trying to grasp after God. No grasping. Let go that which of, in its own essential nature is the moving, the passing away, the dying. Let it die. Because if I don't prevent it from dying at the right time in the right way, which doesn't mean that I must help it to die off, you see, but just let it die, and that is renewal taking place all the time. Life anew. So you see, the form, the feelings, the ideas, the perceptions, consciousness itself is continuously changing, continuously dying, and continuously being born. The river of life is a manifestation of the rhythm of birth-death taking place with inconceivable rapidity. Now, if these things are realized, made real, and they get made real by the purification of oneself, if that realization is there, the making real, then our relationships from moment to moment are the best possible relationships. that can be. You see, one of the very important implications of this, I cannot, of my own will and accord, deliberately make good relationships. It's not possible. I, the imperfect one, the desiring one, the grasping one, the ambitious, envious, impatient if I'm driven sufficiently far, I cannot make goodness. I can't do it. This is a tragic illusion which we human beings, because of our egoism and our pathetic conceit, we suffer from this delusion because of it. That we can make a good relationship, a positively good relationship. Or that we can put it right with somebody. When we seek to put it right with somebody, what are we trying to do? We want our image of what it ought to be to come into being. But the truth of life is immeasurably greater than all this. Therefore, I can't put it right. I must recognize that and acknowledge that. Let be. Remain completely watchful and as quiet as possible. It is the quietness that is the active power. The quietness of the mind, the quietness of my desire, of my thought. No planning behind it. And then what emerges will be the best possible under the circumstances. We don't see this. We want our purposes to be fulfilled. What is my purpose? That which will please me, isn't it? It's the pleasure drive. And I can just never wake up to the fact that the pleasure drive is the pleasure-pain drive. See, the drive of the energy of this whole psychophysical organism is a positive-negative power. It's one power, but it's positive-negative by nature in interplay. It is male-female by nature in interplay. You see? And this male-female aspect of us has not yet come to that stage where it can interplay. The one tries to dominate the other. So there's discord within. But by being quiet, and in the quietness, being awake to the fact, all this is passing away, let it pass. By that quietness, this male-female energy becomes poised and constructive in the true sense. Our idea of the constructive is fossilization. Build a house. Iron and steel, stone and concrete, so forth. To stay forever and ever through time. Remember the words of Sri Krishna, I am time laying desolate the worlds. That's all he says. Laying desolate the worlds. See, the religious life is the most difficult life in the world. But once just that something takes place in us, it becomes the easiest thing. It is this transformation of the nature of our awareness of the world in which we live. We are aware of this world in which we live in finite, separative, fragmentary terms. Whereas the universe is one total reality, a great whole. But because of our confused, wrong awareness of it, we constantly try to introduce discord, fragmentariness, breaking upness all along the line. We are unable to approach life as a whole with ourselves as a whole approaching it. This is the great problem, you know. It's not easy to get rid of this difficulty. It's extremely difficult. All the time, especially in our modern world, in so-called advanced societies, there's a barrage of terrible, hurtful influences coming at us, and we react accordingly, hurtfully, fragmentarily, destructively. Life in its essence is a peaceful flow of universal being. Such a peaceful flow of universal being is constructiveness. See? Not getting fossilized, stuck. Stuck just here. And we try to get stuck because of fear, isn't it? Oh, what will happen if I haven't got a house to go to? Have my meal and go to sleep and all the rest of it. Get stuck. We have this attitude psychologically. I just give the analogy of the physical situation. The physical situation, of course, you have to have a place to go to and live in and so forth. Perfectly true. But psychologically, we do the same. And this is where the trouble comes. And we want just this sort of thing in our human relationships. Therefore, in terms of ought to be's, which are all rigid and fixed, cannot work that way. So we go to this teacher, to that teacher, to join this society, to that society, and they all sort of bait you with, you'll get such and such good results. That bait is the damnation of those societies and teachers. That is the perfect proof that is what one should not go to. Otherwise, the Lord God would have thrown out baits to us from the beginning of time. But he thought fit not to. You may remember, it was year before last, wasn't it? During the autumn, nearing Christmas, I think. Year before last. We considered this business of the unnecessary sorrow from which we suffer. There's a vast heap of unnecessary sorrow which could all be removed just by insight, by real insight. And if that unnecessary sorrow can be cleared out, each one of us would be able to see what it means to be a human being. Human being. The happy thinker. And thinker does not mean, in the religious context certainly, does not mean one who's spinning out word palaces by using his brain and his imagination. Systems of thought, seeking refuge, that is the escapist in us. If we are free of that unnecessary sorrow, we'll find it really easy to stand on our own 2 feet. And standing on our own 2 feet, it'll be much easier to be in right relationship with everything around. Things, objects, situations as they arise, you know, political, economic, social, etc., whatever they are, with persons and with ideas, ideas in the deep sense. And just let's consider this business of thought and the thinker and ideas in the deep sense. We considered just very briefly 3 orders of existence: transcendence, mind only, and the natural order. In the natural order, we, as we are in our living in our bodies, we experience what we miscall thought. Talking, just talking away silently. This is what we call thought. This is all speech. Speech belongs to the natural order, and this miscalled thought belongs to the natural order. But when all thought stops, this picture making and holding on to the pictures as a refuge, as pleasure, and so forth, then this mind only order of existence becomes more operative. This mind only order of existence holds all the archetypal forces. In fact, it is only one archetypal force, but the natural man gives many shapes to that one archetypal force. And he gives it all kinds of names. Through the ages, we have talked about archangels, angels, the different gods, the god of this, the god of that, the god of beauty, goddess of beauty, the god of love, the goddess of wisdom, and and so on and so on. This is the natural man's pictorial representation of his vague awareness of this realm of mind only. But he who can be free of this churning up process from moment to moment in the brain, this churning up of the ocean of words, can in some peculiar way be the channel through which these archetypal forces work creatively. Through us. Now be very careful. They do not create or bring into existence things, situations, conditions like wealth, power, pleasure, happiness. Nothing of that. These archetypal forces out of mind only enable the transformation of our awareness of the one total reality to undergo immense change. One of the essential preconditions for that sort of thing to happen is that what is commonly called thinking and the imaginative process in the natural man, I as I am here, a psychophysical organism, living my everyday life, talking, listening, etc., etc., all that must come to rest. When it comes to rest, this inner element of mind becomes unified in its manifestation through this. Otherwise it's split up into sight impressions, sound impressions, touch impressions, etc., etc., etc. Well, the five senses, including the speech faculty, which manufactures further images. See, when that happens, what we have called peace, love, beauty, action, goodness, rightness, truth, all that undergoes transformation in our own awareness. And it doesn't take a new limited shape. It is transformed into pure power, power which will not get misapplied. This is thought power. The yogis of the old days knew this. But you see, what happens in the world amongst men and women, we who live our lives confined to the natural order, there is this graspingness, this greed, this lust for power, for the assertion of the ego and so forth. So this kind of knowledge inevitably gets misapplied unless there is purification first. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Mervyn, would you kindly? And look.
We get sleepy, you see, if we don't get a bit of air.
Yes, do open that. And Rosemary, could you just lift that window up, please? Yes. It'll go up fairly easily. Yes. Oh, no, not too much. Not too much. That'll be all right. That'll be all right.
I could see you were feeling it instead
of. I'm so sorry. You see how So many systems have arisen, some of them in our own century. Develop thought power. Develop this power. You'll get this, you'll get the other. In other words, we are showing you the way how to dam the river of life instead of letting it flow freely. You dam the river of life and it overflows and one is drowned in it. See, this takes us, I hope this helps us to understand in depth why the religions have taught be free of the bondage to desire. That desire is evil. Desire in itself is not evil. Let us try and understand this, if possible, at its root. Start at the transcendent end. It's a funny expression, transcendent end. However, what can I do? The state of realized transcendence is utterly free of any experience of psychological time. Because I, John Brown, am non-existent. I am not self-conscious at all in that state. It's completely devoid of psychological time. It's devoid of all the psychological processes of the natural order and the natural man. Completely devoid of it. And therefore, this second order of existence, mind only, is utterly empty, luminous, transparent. It is the source of inspiration in the supreme sense. But this physical organism is subject to time and the changes attending chronological time. The body has a rhythm of its own. It has to eat, drink, and excrete and so forth. There's a rhythm. The old yogis, by their disciplines, were able to be free of the creature necessities for as long as 7 days at a stretch. The Buddha claims that. And you will find this claim made in many places. And as a matter of fact, it is not an untrue claim. The mystics of the world, Christians, Sufi, and other mystics, they have made these claims, perhaps not as much as 7 days. Teresa, Saint Teresa, what was it, 3 days or something like that, you see, or whatever it was. You could go for a period like that. But the time comes when this thing must move, this body must move. It must eat, it must excrete, and so forth. Otherwise it would perish, wouldn't it? All right. Which means that that state of awareness, which is realized transcendence, experiences a tremor. And in the experiencing of that tremor, there arises fear, a peculiar fear. I won't talk about that now. But in coming through that second order of existence, of mind only, the primordial male-female energy comes into interplay again. And the power that stirs it to interplay is desire. That is the power named desire. Now, when it interplays in the realm of mind only, all the gods come into being. And desire, pure desire, divine desire, creates the gods as such. What those gods are, the gods know. I don't. But I, the natural man, when functioning as the natural man, make my particular pictorial images of that extraordinary experiencing. Now this male-female, one energy, not a male and a female in interplay, but this duality which is contained in the one single unity comes into play when desire stirs. And after coming back to the state of the natural man, the whole realm of finitude appears, simply because this natural man can be conscious only in terms of finitude, not in terms of infinitude. That is to say, the nature of awareness has undergone complete change. But if one has ever entered that realm, if through one that transcendent experiencing has taken place, then when this natural man through whom it has taken place wakes up again in his natural man state, he is a changed man. He is completely transformed. He is not the same being. He has gone through the portals of death and returned. This is the supreme meaning of resurrection and ascension. If whilst one has not sort of experienced transcendence, then desire, which is a universal energy, is interpreted by this here, the brain, the mind, in innumerable faulty ways. And all the time these faulty interpretations are responsible for the evil, the suffering, the misery that we go through, the frustrations, essentially frustration, all along the line. Therefore, the problem is not to repress these desires, but to observe and so to understand that the faultiness is changed. You can't destroy energy. You can't destroy the universe. That is in physics we talk of the law of conservation of energy matter. Nothing is lost. Nothing is gained either. What will you add to the infinite? What will you subtract out of the infinite? How beautifully the Upanishad puts it in two or three of the Upanishads, or more than two or three. They have this preliminary invocation, as they call it. That is full. This is full. If from fullness you take away fullness, fullness remains. They knew what they were talking of. They didn't talk nonsense. But one has to sort of realize, make real. If this sense of transcendence awakens, then extraordinary things happen inside. Desire becomes pure in a peculiar way, with a purity which we cannot define. And this unnecessary sorrow, which is the result of evil desires, is out. And all the conflict associated with it. But the natural man mustn't strive to do the positive thing according to his conception of positive. His business is to watch with complete intensity and understand. This is the deep meaning of mindfulness, samasati, the watch and pray which Jesus talked of. This is one of the deep meanings of it. We have talked a good bit about this through the years, haven't we, Frank? Now I'll ask you one thing. Don't sort of try to fix in your mind, three orders of existence. Transcendence, mind only, natural man, right, all written down. Now you think you've got some information, some knowledge. You've got nothing at all. That is illusion. That's the way of illusion. But if the words, if when you go home or anywhere, you recall this and it produces that kind of living stir in you and transforms your awareness of existence, your own existence and the situation around you, then it is all useful. Remember, you never swallow the knives and forks. It's the food that you chew and swallow. Isn't that so? Well, these are all these things that I say are the knives and forks. Don't swallow them for God, for goodness sake. Otherwise you'll be a little bit uncomfortable. Now you see, let the mind quietly dwell upon these things. Just quietly dwell upon these things. Let it simmer, cook inside by itself. And see what emerges. As you let the mind dwell upon it and it all simmers, watch all the disturbance that takes place here. Because all sorts of reactions will inevitably arise. You can't avoid that. No one can avoid it. Just watch the process. You see? And then see how it affects relationships. The affecting of relationships will be primarily due to the fact that I myself have changed. And change not according to my preconception, which is tainted with my ignorance and folly and desire and grasping and power lust and all the rest of it. It will not have changed according to my preconception, but it will have undergone change which is living growth, healthy growth. And then, because I am different, naturally relationships become different. The one thing you will find, which will be a source of tremendous help, you will become very much more absorptive. You can take it. You can take the strain. It doesn't bowl you over. You still remain balanced, although the strain becomes bigger and bigger. The battering from the outside world. Isn't there a German something, Ein feste Burg, what is it? The Lord our God is a great fortress. That's the idea, isn't it? What is this great fortress? Not a Lord God up there, but this which has undergone the change becomes a fortress, not because it repels the outside world's attack, but because it absorbs it all comfortably, lets it flow through one. This is the way. Otherwise one is in conflict. And then you see the problem of power and the misuse of power, which takes place all day, every day, throughout the world. That problem yields. All relationships involve power in action, the use, the misuse of power. So as I change, become absorptive, and that inner transformative energy becomes operative, then power does not get misused. There is peace. There's one other thing. There's many other things, but one of the many other things is this, that the power of thought in the real sense operates through the natural man better and better, without one's knowing it. One must never seek to utilize that power. You have probably heard of the term. In fact, I'm sure you have all heard of the term Tantra Yoga. Beware, it's the utilization of power. But only the pure one, who is quite unconcerned with power, is the instrument through whom power is rightly utilized. This is the point. That's enough for today. Those of you who are interested, relate this thought and the ideas which emerge in the realm of mind only to what Plato taught about the archetypal ideas. You remember in the Gita, by the way, is everyone acquainted with the Gita?
No.
Good.
No.
No? Those who worship the devas, unto the devas they go, but those who worship me come unto me. And Sri Krishna, the person, symbolizes that complete harmonious unity of transcendence, mind only, the natural man. This is the real meaning of the Son of God in Christian teaching. And you see, this Son of God idea teaching and the Son of Man teaching is really derived from Jewish mysticism, not just the external shape of the Old Testament, but the esoteric teaching which is wrapped up in the Old Testament. Those who worship the ideas, the devas, the archetypes, unto the archetypes they go. But those who worship me come unto me. And Sri Krishna talks of his abode as the imperishable. That unmanifested which is over and above the unmanifested that you and I, mortals, talk about. We talk of the manifested and the unmanifested. And the movement from the manifested to the unmanifested and back again into the manifested is through the portals of death. One may put it this way: when this organism is born, it has died out of the unmanifest state. Not it has died, because it wasn't there. There is a dying out of the unmanifest, and there becomes manifest this. This dies, and that which was this goes back into the unmanifested state. So you get this rhythm. Birth, death, rhythm. But when transcendence, after the first tremor, comes into the realm of mind only, this male, female in perfect poise, it's a life-death rhythm where death and life are identical. In other words, death is other life. Otherwise there'd be complete destruction, there'd be annihilation. These things are implicit in Buddhism, only Orthodox Buddhism just never touches it.
But you do not mean by this rebirth theory?
No. Not the reincarnational picture. This birth-death rhythm, I do not mean the reincarnational picture at all. This is something which even the ordinary logical brain can work out carefully. This is a manifestation of a limited, finite something. On its return to the unmanifested, it has become the non-identifiable. You can't collect elements out of the non-identifiable and remake a pattern which is similar to or bears any real relationship to the old pattern. Cannot be done. You see, energies, forces, are spaceless and timeless, aren't they? Electricity, magnetism. They manifest through space, time, and finite mechanisms. But they themselves are the indeterminates. They are indeterminable. When this returns to the indeterminable, there can be no return of Firoz Mehta or a continuity of Firoz Mehta. See, even logically one can show that this reincarnational picture is false. But the influences which play take new shape. How? The Lord knows. No one knows. The Buddha himself didn't give any rationale of it. And certainly the great Hindu teachers almost purposely misled people by saying, oh, your Atma comes back, just like that. I think they got impatient and fed up with these half-witted people who kept on asking questions. So they finally shut them up that way. But the real teaching is sufficiently clear in plain statements in the Upanishads, the original statement. Samsara, the cycle of births and deaths is just one's own thought, unequivocally said in the Maitri and the Shandilya Upanishads, to take only two. When the fluctuations of attention cease, the cycle of births and deaths comes to an end. Now, what can attend? Or who can attend? And in whom can fluctuations of attention take place? In the living, finite, natural man. When this thing dies, consciousness goes with it. It doesn't float about in space like an entity. It doesn't happen. See, this is where the great error comes. It's so difficult. It's so difficult to sort of get free of this grasping I want to persist through all time. I'll be a good chap. I'll work jolly hard, oh Lord. Give me a nice front seat in heaven afterwards. This is nonsense. Immaturity. Horrible immaturity. Stand on your own two feet and know the joy of it. It'll be exactly like flying with angels' wings through the aerial spaces, untrammeled. You'll be strong with the strength that can never be overcome, however much it is tried. That'll mean peace inside and the freedom from this deep-seated struggle in the psyche. And it will also mean the freedom from unnecessary sorrow. Do meditate on these things. You'll find release. Let what you remember of what you hear, a word even, just let the mind dwell quietly on the word. The mind must be at peace, inactive, but completely alert, awake. And that thing will work in the psyche. It's like a seed which is sown. And if you don't interfere with the growth of the plant, there'll be flowers.